Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth Perler, and welcome to the Executive Function Summit. And right now, we are going to start speaking with Michael Dellman from BeyondBooksmart.com. And Michael Dellman is an executive function coach, which is what I am, and I'm so excited to hear his approach to executive function coaching. He's been an educator since 1982. He has a big focus on relevancy, which I really like, where we need to make curriculum and learning relevant to the students. And he talks a lot about digging deep into what the students care about, finding out what they're made of. And Michael helped found an expeditionary learning-based school. He was the principal for a while. He was an educator. He has a book called Your Kid's Gonna Be Okay, which Michael, somebody else actually brought up to me today. And Michael talks also a lot about when we're working with kids, helping them find what's their talent, what's their passion, how do they want to impact things with their talent, where can they excel, what are their passions, so things like that. So I really like how he's so focused on them rather than trying to get students to fit into our box, like what makes them them. So before we get deeper into the background, Michael, what are the key objectives you want to cover with us today and you want to teach parents about?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, thank you so much, Seth. I'm really excited about your summit, and you have just a wonderful idea to create this and bring help to so many people. So I'm glad to be part of it. So for today, what I'm most interested in is helping parents understand what it takes to help your kids make changes and to feel empowered to make their own changes instead of feeling that, oh, what a burden this is, what a battle this is, what a terrible, nightmare I'm stuck in. I want to help reframe it for parents as opportunities that can actually be pretty fun if you can find a way to reframe it. So that's first. And that's hard because we can get caught in these battles. It's a normal, natural thing, but there's a way out. And I'd like to make sure that I share that. Secondly, I want parents to understand and I speak as a parent too of two teenagers, kind of understanding the time frame for this and what the developmental trajectory looks like. So it's not, you don't want to think of this as a light a firecracker and things will just suddenly take off, but to have kind of the patience of growing trees and how, that's how we want to think of our kids, is this kind of long-term patience that we're going to need changes over time. And then really the third part is understanding a bit about some of the things that we can do today, right now, depending on what the specific executive function skill challenges are that our kids face. And I say this also, Seth, with empathy for parents who also have executive function challenges. Mm. I've got them too. I know this. I work with them every day on myself. I work with them with my own kids. I work with them with professionally as a coach and leader of a company. So I hope parents will walk away able to understand kind of the time frame, the way to interact, and then the tools that'll be really practical and useful.
Excellent. I cannot wait to dive into that.
And I'm excited.
And I'm so excited to hear about the time frame because I talk about that so much. So I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but it's such an important topic because we want things to happen fast, but they don't. Mm-hmm. Cool. So thank you for giving us some of the objectives. Now we'll dive into background for a few minutes and really deep dive into some of your background. And then we'll get really deep into the problems and the solutions for parents. So I got a few rapid fire questions for you. So Michael, who are you personally? I know you're talking about Ultimate Frisbee a little bit today. On a personal level, tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, sure. So I cleared 50 a couple years ago, and I'm enjoying my 50s. I've got these two wonderful daughters. One's just finishing freshman year of high school. The other just finished freshman year of college. A wonderful wife, and then we also have a new puppy. So that's kind of my household. I mentioned I'm an Ultimate Frisbee aficionado, so I love that. play a little guitar. I have two guitars. I see you've got three up on the wall there. But I don't play particularly well. I just enjoy it. I would describe myself though basically as someone who's an educator at heart. And after being a teacher for 8 years, I then started a charter school partnered with Outward Bound, and that's in Framingham, Massachusetts. It's still there. Great school. And 13 years ago, I started Beyond Booksmart, which is the nation's largest executive function coaching company. We have 400 coaches, so in 10 different states. So for me, my own executive function skills have been dramatically, challenged, and then I've had to work on solutions just to grow that kind of company over time. Oh, and yeah. And I've also had to recognize who has strengths that kind of counterbalance mine, because there are certain things I do well and certain things I just don't. And I've learned to work around some of my, weaker areas. So anyway, so that's a basic background on me. And I don't know, Seth, I guess I'm a big lover of life too. I can say I love life, and I've had my struggles and challenges, but that's all like good grist for the mill. So,
and that's how it should be, and that's what we want for our kids. And I think that's probably why you and I both do what we do, because we want to love life ourselves, and we want kids to grow up and be kids who love life and become adults who love life. So. About the professional background, you went into the professional. Anything else you wanted to mention about your professional background?
I don't think so particularly. I mean, it's my master's degree is in middle school education. I guess I started there because I just think middle school kids are incredibly cool and challenging and exciting. And I'm still kind of a middle school kid at heart in some ways. A ridiculous seventh grade sense of humor. I'm sure it'll come out in the interview. But I love it because they're an age where they're intellectually smart enough that they can see different perspectives, but they're very young and still able to really keep an open mind and to try things out. And so I think trying to work with kids with executive function challenges, I think middle school is a pretty exciting time. Just a funny thing. When I was starting my school, someone said, So Michael, is your school for troubled kids? And I said, well, it's a middle school, so yes.
Good response.
It's a tough time. So I do have a particular enjoyment of helping kids at that age, but I love working with people of any age too.
It's so such a pivotal time, and it's not for everybody. I've heard so many teachers of older or younger than middle school kids who are like, I can't stand middle school kids.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yep.
I think they're super cool, but you have to have a certain type of thick skin for middle school kids.
You do.
Let me ask you about how do you help families specifically? And I want to set up sort of what we're going to get into with this, so that they can kind of be imagining, am I the type of parent that Michael would be working with my kid? What's your, not the company's, but your superpower as far as working with people who struggle with executive function?
Tough to separate me out from kind of the way we built things, but I think when I think about me personally, it often comes down to finding that connection with a kid. One of my kids I worked with a couple of years ago played ultimate frisbee. We'd go out, we'd toss the disc around to get started and to kind of talk about how things are going. And that was a way for him to de-stress after school, but before settling in to do the work for the schoolwork and tackling difficult executive function challenges. Throwing the disc around. Another kid played guitar, and so although I mentioned I'm not that good, I had him teach me a couple of things with bar chords and how to do it. And I asked him, how do you do that? And he said, well, you just do this one and that one. It's a bunch of very small things, and you end up with a big thing like this bar chord. And I said, that's what writing is like. It's a bunch of small things, and then it ends up. And so I think my superpower is being able to, I've never really thought of it in that term, but I like it, is being able to make a connection between what the kid's interest and talent, and what their passion, their talent is, and then what it is that they need to be working on. And I also don't oversell. I don't oversell for a kid like, this is so important. You're absolutely going to need to know like trigonometry when you're older. No, but you're absolutely going to need to be able to push yourself through things you don't like to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so I think the honesty, Seth, and the connection to what it is that they love is that, I think that those two things.
You and I are so aligned on so many levels. I love it. I just really like, it's the relationship first, the connection, you know, that's what we have to build first. Mm-hmm. And then we can help exactly what you're saying, like push them, even though, you know, you may not use trigonometry. How do we find value in it? Where is the value in it? How do you push yourself through this stuff? Like, you need to do those things in life so that you can do anything you want to do. Awesome. Awesome. And then, what is the story? I have three more of the rapid fires, but what's the story behind why this matters to you? How did you get into this? Why do you even do this? I know why I do.
Okay. So, and I'd love to hear about you, as well, but you know, so for me, so I taught English, I taught math, I taught science, public school. Nobody loves semicolons more than I do. And I was, fractions are my friend. You know, I love all that stuff. However, what I really loved was the idea of helping people find out and helping kids find out how they could be more effective. And so my after school help sessions with kids were often focused on that. Before we would take math tests, the kids would take their math tests. I'd always have them all put their heads down and I would say, okay, you're about to take the math test. You've done everything you can now to be ready. Let's relax now. Take a moment to just remember that you're here and you've done everything you can. So, you know, trying to get their, like, their amygdala regulated, mm-hmm. their prefrontal cortex engaged, get them calm. And we can talk more about that stuff later if you think it makes sense. So getting them calm and focused, for me, that stuff was what always was my passion as an educator. Now, cut back a layer and you go down to me personally. When I was younger, I struggled with this stuff in a way that it's remarkable to me that I did as well as I did. In my book, one of the terrible stories that I share is the one where this teacher said, I was talking to a friend in class and the teacher said, "Well, Mr. Delman, am I interrupting you?" And I said, "Yeah, but I'm going to let it go this time." And boom, I was out of that classroom like lickety split. You know, I was so impulsive and, I challenged authority all the time, which isn't always a bad thing. It can be a great thing, mm-hmm. but I did it indiscriminately. I didn't have the self-control to know when it was appropriate and when it wasn't. I would get very anxious. And so I would do everything too much. And then sometimes I'd lose focus and just not do something till the very last minute. So I dealt with a lot of these challenges personally. And I think that is what gets a lot of us into it. It's just eventually, Seth, I decided I wanted to help kids academically. And then I went to something bigger, which was the school. And then even bigger, which is the company. So I felt like that was a real opportunity to help people learn what I learned and build and teach the tools that I'd learned over time.
Awesome. Awesome. I like how purpose-driven you are. And so I just love meeting people who are aligned, because we're not on the summit because we want kids to get better grades. We don't do what we do because we want them to get better grades or get into great colleges, or it's because we want them to have a good quality of life. So, all right, two more. This one's hard. You ready? Sure. How do you define executive function in one sentence?
Two words, being effective. That'd be my short version. Slightly longer.
Here comes the longer. That's my next question.
How to get things done. You know, but executive function skills are about getting things done, getting important things done effectively.
Nice. Do you want to go in a little bit more depth, or should we, because that was my last.
I'd be happy to. I could do it now. I could do it later. You tell me.
Let's do it now. Give us sort of your spiel on, sure. If you're really talking to a parent who has never heard of this before and they're like worried about their kid and they're like, I know it has something to do with this executive function thing. I know it means getting important things done effectively. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, let's dive into that a little bit.
Sure. So, there are a lot of good metaphors out there. I think I'll stick with the basic idea for executive function skills are that you're able to set goals and regulate yourself to achieve those goals. So you're able to establish what's important to you and then regulate yourself along the way through all the other executive function skills, like being able to focus and manage distractions, being able to get started on things that you don't want to do, but you know you need to do to get to what you really want. It's being able to discount the present sometimes, like what you feel like you want right now for a bigger payoff later.
So what kind of goals, cause I've heard plenty of kids, I'm sure you have too, who say, I don't know what my goals are.
Yeah. So, I think even the kids that don't have, and this is most kids, the majority of kids, they don't have a really crystal clear vision for what they want in life yet. And that's just great. That's totally fine. Normal. I've got one kid who does and one who doesn't. And it's, very normal. But I think all kids, they do have a general sense of some overall life goals that they've got. Like they want to be probably able to take care of themselves and be successful and independent and make their way in the world. They want to be able to be, have like good relationships with people, friends, family, maybe something, a love interest in some fashion, someone special in their lives. They want to be healthy, so these are things that are kind of generally common human values. We all may differ on the particulars. We certainly do as people. But I think when you're thinking about what a kid wants, there's what they want right now, which is, I want to play Fortnite, right? Uh-huh. I want to get on Snapchat right now. And those aren't crazy things. There's reasons why those things are appealing. Maybe we'll get into that later. There are really good reasons why Fortnite and Snapchat appeal so much to kids and even adults right? The way the brain, the way we're wired, the reward system. But if that's all we did was just what gave us pleasure in the moment, we actually, we know this and we see this sometimes with people, but we would end up not only not achieving the basic things we need, like health and security and happiness, but we would be very dissatisfied with ourselves. There's a sense of kind of achievement and accomplishment that is also very intrinsic to people. We like to succeed at things. So that's why successes lead to more success and failures lead to more failure. That's why we need to help people when they're in those vicious cycles. So I think, overall for executive function skills, I want parents to be able to help their kids look beyond just the moment and still to enjoy the moment, to be able to have a nice balance between what gives you joy and just immediate pleasure even now, and then what's helping you to ensure that you have good choices for yourself and a lot of opportunity, later into the future.
Right. Because if they don't figure out how to execute on those things, that's what's at risk here is that future in favor of the short term. Yeah. So there needs to be both. Awesome. 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 Thank you so much. Are you ready to dive super deep?
Oh yeah. I may have to put my glasses on for this part though.
All right.
I'm feeling smart now.
So now we'll go into the real meat of this session, and we're going to look at the problem and the solution. And so I guess starting off with the problem and the solution together, what in your work as an executive function coach, how would you describe to a parent, your kid's at point A and we're trying to get to point B? What transformation do you take mm-hmm. them through? What is this point and what is this point?
Yeah. So the point A where, you know, I see so many families come in is the problem's not just one thing. It's a system. It's often a family system as well. So the first thing you see is you often see a kid who is disengaged, depressed, either clinically or just, you know, maybe more the way people casually throw out the word of just being really like feeling hopeless, anxious, and sometimes you get to the point of feeling where they'll feel self-loathing, hopelessness, depression, shame. And sometimes just they might go to the direction of just kind of a screw it attitude. You know, this is the teacher doesn't like me. My mom's always on my case, whatever. What you simultaneously see at kind of point A is you see a parent who is often very anxious themselves at this point. My kid's never going to be okay. They're never going to graduate high school or be able to be independent. I'm freaking out. He's already in third grade. No, I'm just kidding. You know, but sometimes they're like that really, really early. And you know, I've just heard this over and over. My kid's never going to make it. My kid's never going to make it. And I talked to the kids. And I don't know if when we had our first conversation, if I shared this with you, but it's a shocking thing to me to hear how many kids are literally worried about ending up homeless. And these are kids who don't come from financial instability, where that's like a real worry. It's where they're just freaked out that they are going to be such failures that they're going to end up really on the streets, in spite of coming from a family that has a lot of resources mm-hmm. or, you know, a stable family.
We didn't talk about that, but in your point A, I mean, you gotta wonder, like, how did that internal dialogue get there? You know?
And well, you do wonder, and sometimes you don't wonder forever because you hear a comment from a parent like, you are never going to make it, young man, or, you know, young lady, you think the real world's going to put up with you, you know, no one's going to want to be around you if you, you know, so it's these, and I know, you know, I'm a parent. We all say things occasionally that were really damaging things that we wish we didn't say, but sometimes the repair work isn't done. The coming back and the fixing and the apology and the taking the time to learn how to approach your kids that you'll do better next time. And that's what I spend a lot of time. I worked on it a lot for myself and as an educator, as a dad and as a professional. So I think that, you know, the problem in part A or point A, it's the kid, but it's the system they're in. It's a family who has come to see them a certain way, and they identify with it now.
Before you even get to the B, tell me what, because you know that's some of the deeper stuff. What's the surfacey stuff that people come in and they say,
"Oh,
hey, here's why I'm here stuff. Today."
I sorry, Seth, I went deep on you right away.
No, that's awesome.
The surfacey stuff is simple. The surfacey stuff is, my kid's not doing their homework, that when they do, it's sloppy or it's late, that they just rush it to get it done. My kid does like a wait, too late, you know. Oh, I don't need to do my project. The paper, I'll get it done. Oh my God, it's too late to even start. I'm freaking out. So there's this like, wait, too late.
You and I hear the exact same things, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and in fact, I mean, you know, there's that that bell curve of the peak arousal or peak productivity chart. And on the one side is not feeling enough adrenaline, enough investment, enough drive. And on the other side is too much energy and overwhelmed and freaking out. And you kind of need the just right level of engagement. Just the amount of, yes, I want this, I can do it. It's a little bit scary, and I'm okay to do that. So when we take on something new, for example, and we get that little extra drive, it can be very productive energy.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, with kids and families, the very normal surface things are homework's bad, projects and papers are avoided till the last minute. Sometimes it's my kid works all hours of the night, so mm-hmm. we get the other thing. I don't even know what they're doing with all their time, mm-hmm. but it's you know, they're saying they're working really hard, and or even they're getting good grades, but they're miserable, mm-hmm. and my kid's totally inefficient. Those kinds of things.
And then you've taken them through coaching. You've really worked with them. You've really been able to get them to a point B. What does that look like? And you can talk surfacey and a little bit.
So, I mean, you know, on the surface level, the simplest thing is that, and I know, you know, we don't say, you know, better grades today. It's a more effective student tomorrow is our kind of, you know, that's really kind of a slogan. It's a more effective student. It's a student that if I were to say to a student at point B, what would you do if I wasn't here? They could tell you. They'd say, well, the first thing I do is I estimate how long each assignment's going to take. And then I figure out, okay, how urgent is this? How important? You know, I'm using the Covey quadrants. They'd have language for it. We've got like 400 different tools. They're all sorted by executive function skill.
But and they have a level of awareness where
they have a self-awareness. A
dialogue exactly. with you.
They could tell you what they would do, and they could tell you when they get stuck what they would do. Like, now I know I get distracted, you know, by the YouTube stuff. So there's an app blocker for that. I know that my phone, distracts me, so I use the Forest app so I don't look at my phone. I also know that after 30 minutes of math, I generally need a break. I know when it's a paper, I should set a 5-minute goal so I can get myself started and just not worry about the whole paper. Just see what I can do in 5 minutes. That's how I overcome, you know, writer's block. You know, they would know what the likely, so the, at point B, when they're ready to graduate, you know, they know what their challenges are, and they know how to work with them.
Graduate from high school or from your programming?
Coaching. Okay. And it's not a program that's like, you do step A, B, C, D, E. It's, no, when you've gone through these different stages of change and you're ready to take, you're taking full responsibility for yourself. That's
yeah. We talk about things in terms of steps or systems, but yeah, it's really such an abstract,
it's fluid
combination of things that give that person to that point B.
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I can lay that out more, but you know, in our system, we base it on something called the trans-theoretical model of change.
I'll get to that in a bit.
Okay. Skip it for now. Yeah.
So now I wanted, and we did go pretty deep into the problem, but I do want to go even more deep into the problem before we get even deeper into the solution and then some actionable things that parents can do. But let's see, I'm looking at my notes here. Okay.
Can I jump in with one thing I didn't say on that, on point B? Well, I didn't say, you know, I kind of jokingly saying, and they glow, they radiate. But in seriousness, there really is, parents will say, it's like my kid's a different person. And the kids will say, I just feel so much more confident. And there's this generalizability, this application that goes beyond, oh, now I'm a decent student. I get my work in on time. You know, kids don't want to just feel like robots who can just go through the motions. There's this, I know how to navigate the things that are just annoying and I have to get through. I know how to do really well at the things I care about. And I can take more risks on other things. Like one of my students has this thing about, but not only did he get better at his academics, but he founded a club on a topic no one had ever done at his high school. Founded an improv comedy club, and that's cool, you know, like but he never would have done that before because he didn't think that he had the capacity to build and start and follow through.
Yeah, it's like what we're talking about here is not like small shifts. It's like a human being has changed. There has been the needle has moved enough where something's different. A different light has gone on. This is not woo-woo. This is real life. Like, we've helped people, and I'm glad you said that, because I want parents to walk away from this whole thing if they aren't already there, knowing there is absolutely hope. I don't have to be worried that my third grader is not going to be able to make it. Like, it takes time, but there can be a shift in a human being where they're just, you're like, oh, they've got it.
Yeah, absolutely. And they see themselves differently. The kids see themselves differently too. It's not just the parents are like, my kids.
They have agency.
Like, the kids are, yeah, they have agency, and they feel, if you overcome enough challenges, you start to see the possibility of overcoming challenges generally. You start to see, I may not be able to do anything, but I can always get better. You get that growth mindset that Carol Dweck talks about. Mm. You know, you really start to get that whole, I'm someone that can grow and change. Who knows how far I could go with things? So, yeah. Anyway, back to your next question. I'm sorry to interrupt.
But awesome. So this is more on the problem side of it. What are some of the blind spots that you see over and over again, either with a student or a parent or teachers? Now, obviously, we're speaking generally to parents here, but I know that we both see probably a lot of the same ones in all three. But what are some of the big blind spots and myths and misunderstandings and that we have when we're trying to help a kid? And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so there's, you know, I think some of them are very personal and idiosyncratic to the particular parent. But a story might illustrate this. I was giving a talk to a book talk and to a group of parents, and this one mom raises her hand. She said, my kid doesn't talk. Like I ask him questions like, how was your day? And whatever, he doesn't really answer. I said, what grade is he? She said, seventh grade. I said, wait, like 3 years, you know? Okay. And she said, it's like we're sitting at dinner and I ask him things and he just won't answer. And she just kept going and going. And everybody slowly, like, we're talking about like 100 people, start to turn toward her. And she was oblivious to it. And she kept going and going. And I started to feel this like pit in my stomach and this anxiety. And I thought, that's how her kid feels. It's just like, you can't get a word in. That's why he doesn't talk. And I said, can I? And she kept going. And so when she kind of slowed down, I said, part of it isn't personal. Part of it is just the age. And let me ask you, is it any better when you're in a car with him? And she said, yeah, it's a lot better when I'm driving him somewhere. And I said, has anyone ever, you know, you mentioned maybe, you know, you're kind of like an intense person with a lot of energy. She said, oh my God. And she started to go off again. I said, hold on. I said, that intensity is something that can be a little overwhelming for some personalities. And when you're facing forward in the car and your son is facing forward and you're not looking at each other, it might be a little bit less intense for him. And so he's able to open up to you a little bit more. And she said, well, what about the dinner table? And I said, maybe turn his chair facing the other way. Mm-hmm. Have a dinner facing the opposite direction. You know, we were all laughing and she laughed. But it's interesting to me and how blind we all can be to the impact we have on other people. Mm-hmm. I know I have my blind spots. We have a name we use in you know, in our company, which is DKDK. There's the stuff that you know, that's the K. There's the stuff you don't know, but you're aware that you're ignorant. That's the DK. And then there's the DKDK, the stuff you didn't even know you didn't know. Like your blind spots, as you call them. You know, I didn't even know I didn't know that. Like, she had no idea about that she was having this impact on her. She was like, this is going to make a huge difference. So that's one thing. more generally, and you know, for everybody.
Can I reel that one in real quick and relate that? Because I think that's really important. I think that one of the blind spots is when we don't know what we don't know. And I think that what that ties in for me so well to is this whole idea of mindfulness.
Yes. But
to me, mindfulness is the same as self-awareness, is the same as consciousness, being conscious of your behavior. And so much of our life is spent on auto control, and we're not aware of what we're doing, saying, what we're thinking, what we're feeling. And then ultimately we're driven by things unconsciously or without self-awareness. And my game and your game is has a lot to do with empowering parents and kids to develop some of that awareness so that we can create the changes that we're seeking to create. And if we don't get that awareness, I mean, we might get lucky sometimes and make some good changes, but generally speaking, it's going to be at a snail's pace.
Yeah, it's really well said. It's pretty exciting when we get those epiphanies, but we can more systematically get them if we're, you know, constantly aiming to pay attention to
yes.
them. I get two thoughts on this if I can. So the first thought is just from this morning, this workshop I gave to a high school staff, and one of the teachers shared an epiphany that they'd had, and it was that this student who erupts, was erupting because they were super anxious and they had no idea what to do about it, which made them even more anxious, which made them erupt more, which made them more anxious, and you know, so on, so on. And the teacher, when they had realized this, they were able to then excuse the student in two manners. One, excuse them in their own heart, their own mind, mm-hmm. to say, this kid just doesn't know what the hell to do.
As opposed to saying, this kid just needs to control themselves.
Exactly. And then secondly, physically excuse him. Like, you know, why don't you take a minute and go get a drink of water and come back. And when you come back, you know, I have every confidence that you're going to be okay. And having that belief or saying, normalizing it for the kids, saying, look, a lot of kids get stressed out. It's okay. Go take a break. Come back. That was this kind of blind spot removed for the teacher, and it was just so helpful for the kid, and also of course so helpful for the teacher, right? Because you know it can make you feel crazy as a parent or a teacher to feel like I don't even know what to do. I may as well, you know, just yell or whatever because nothing else is working.
And a lot of us, that's, you know, we grew up, Michael, with our own dysfunction. Every person watching this, your family may have had this much or this much. There's no shame in it, but we all grew up with some level of, hey, here's how you respond to this. And oftentimes it's not a really effective way, like what you're describing with this teacher's epiphany, where the teacher's saying, hey, I can hold space for this kid in a different way. You know, help them on a whole different level that will then empower them to tap back into their executive function and get more out of the class.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That 2 minute break that kid took, that just bought that kid 30 minutes of effective class time. Mm-hmm. And also not having the entire class unravel, you know, just for a parent, how nice is it if you can just reset kids having a problem, get them aside for a minute, let them take a moment to express what's on their mind, whatever, you know, and then, okay, let's go back to the task or let's go back to the homework or, you know, take a break for a bit or well worth, you know, it's an investment. And
well, let me dig into the problem in a little bit of a different way now. So that was sort of like the question about blind spots.
Yeah.
But what about a more broad question about what's holding these kids back?
It is tough to be a kid today. Again, I would say, Seth, it definitely depends on the age of the kid because, you know, you look at middle school kids, as I mentioned, you know, some of my favorites and they're just oh my God, you know, they're just going through so many physical changes. So that wreaks havoc on the ability to just be calm and regulate yourself. For younger kids, it's really just a lot of skills, not as well-developed elementary set. They are, their self-awareness is really just beginning. And then for older kids, they've got bigger stresses and busy schedules that are really, really, really hard. I think what holds them back are probably two things overall, and I'm thinking more toward the middle school, high school, and an older set. One is definitely anxiety. There is an epidemic of it now. People are very anxious. Kids are worried about not making it. Kids are worried about competition. It's real. It's harder to get into the colleges that we got into when we were kids. You know, it's just the standards are tougher. It's harder to stay in college. One in three kids is not returning to where they started freshman year, or just leaving altogether. The graduation rates are really startlingly low. It's tough. So I think it is very hard, and the distractions are much better and greater for kids today. So part of it's anxiety, and part of it is a feeling of irrelevance. Why does it matter? I can learn anything I want on Google. I can just go figure it out anyway. This whole school thing is kind of dumb. And then the third thing, and I'm just going to share this because although it may not be the focus of our talk, I think it's important. I think there's a bit of an existential crisis. Maybe there always is for every generation, but you know, this day and age, it's the climate crisis, and a real reason for kids to worry about, oh my gosh, what's our planet going to be like in 20 years?
I'm worried for them.
I'm worried too, you know, and I'm involved in that stuff, and I get that. And then they also have this, like, the U.S. is not as much of a superpower as it used to be. So here at home, we've got that issue, much more competition. So, you know, from abroad. And I think you put all that together, you can understand why kids are worried and sometimes figuring, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I can't get into this rat race. It just seems just too crazy.
Yeah. And they're also the exposure to these intense concepts that they're exposed to, as opposed to how much of it we were exposed to. It's got to be so intense.
Well, you mean the fact that the news is ever, like, that they see stuff on YouTube and Instagram and everywhere else.
We would have to watch it on TV or read the newspaper if we were going to see intensity like that.
There was so much we didn't know. So many violent images and television shows that they have access to on Netflix that most parents are not able to manage and don't want to manage their kids every single, you know, thing we want them to. This gets back to executive function skills. It speaks again to why it's so important for kids to learn to process things and make sense of things and learn how to know how to set their own boundaries. You know, for me and my wife, we let our kids make a lot of decisions for themselves because we're there to give them advice if they want and to give them feedback and help them process after. But we want them to have a lot of practice because, you know, I don't want my kids going off into the world being overprotected and I have no idea how to cope and overwhelmed by everything out there. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a gradual release that you know. I'd love to hear more questions about that.
Well, let's stick with the unpacking the problem even a little bit more, and we'll end on this point here. But what are some of the biggest misunderstandings that you see repeated? What are some examples that you see in your practice where a parent just does not understand something? They don't know that they don't know. But what are some common myths or misunderstandings that a lot of the people that come in have?
Well, certainly the myth of laziness is the first. I mean, that this, you know, my kid ought to be able to do this. Really? You know, they ought to? Where does it say that? Like, where did you read that they ought to? There can be this idea that there's kind of one right way, one right time period. my first child was just fine. What's my second kid is just kind of has an attitude problem, or, you know, is lazy. And just, you know, for any parent, and I want to say this one straight to the camera set, for any parent out there where you think your child is just lazy and they don't want it, I'm not saying it doesn't become a sense of learned helplessness and that they give up, but it doesn't start that way.
It starts very with, well put.
It starts with, I don't know what to do. There's something that's hard and I'm losing my confidence and I'm getting scared to take a risk and I'm not going to put in the same effort because it hasn't been working out. And I really don't know how to put in effective effort. It just feels it. And then it gets worse. And then there really is the giving up. So it is this cycle, but it doesn't just start off with, oh yeah, I don't give a hoot. Mm-hmm. You know, people used to think that about kids who are dyslexic. Oh, they're not trying hard enough. Turns out now, thankfully, we understand that part now. Now we understand ADHD much, much better. Now, and there are people that still don't buy into it, but most people get it, you know? And then there are people that really don't understand executive function skills and the real challenges and how habits are formed and how hard it is to break habits, you know, and how hard it is to learn new skills. So I think that's the thing.
So then, based on, let's say, the myth of laziness and all the
judgmentalness that comes with it, yes.
What are the mistakes that people make? They have this misunderstanding, and then what actions or words do they use that are, you know, that are based on this misunderstanding?
Yeah, generally, I think there are two phrases that are used that are really mistaken. The first is just try harder. If you put your mind to it, you know, the old pull yourself up by the bootstraps. I absolutely believe in hard effort. I really do. But the effort is only useful if you know how to apply your effort effectively. So that's first, is just try harder. The other one, and this was a failed social experiment you'll probably remember well, is you're so smart, you can do this. Just telling a kid how smart they are actually can make them feel a lot worse. It can,
you know, I know you're bright.
Right? You know, oh, you're so smart. What goes through a kid's head when they're doing badly and they're told over and over how smart they are? Oh, well, I must be a really awful person, or they are lying to me and they're just trying to butter me up. They really think I'm such a loser that they need to lie to me. I mean, you know, the thoughts are not going to be good ones. Parent tells you to try harder. Oh, see, they don't even get me. They don't really care how I feel. Oh, I'm so smart. Oh, they are so clueless. They have no idea. They don't know me at all. They have no idea how hard this is for me. So, you know, you don't have to then say to your kid, oh, you're dumb. Oh, I know. It must be hard. You're so dumb. Obviously, that's not what we believe, and it's not the truth. It's, no, this is hard. We haven't figured out the solution yet, and we're going to try some things. We'll get into how to solve it. But those are two of the things that do the most damage.
Yeah. I don't want to get ahead of myself either at this point, but what you just said brings it all the way back full circle to the very beginning of the conversation when you talked about connection. Mm-hmm. And how, if you're going to be successful with the kids you're working with, you got to start with this connection, and that's sort of your superpower. And in a mm-hmm. weird way, it's not rocket science, but in another way, with all of our, you know, habituated patterns that we've grown mm-hmm. up with, it is hard. And it is rocket science in that way. So part of our job is, how do we empower parents to sort of see this? And then what it brings back to is something that you and I haven't talked about yet. Maybe we will, but I know I talk about it all the time, but that connection to me goes mm-hmm. back to attachment theory and healthy and secure attachment. And when I'm an educator, when I'm a coach, when I'm working with kids, what I'm trying to do is create, it's the relationship, the healthy, secure attachment, the connection. It's all the same, right? I need to make, if I'm going to help this kid who's struggling with this and who's resistant and has all had all these experiences, mm-hmm. I better make them feel seen and heard and mm-hmm. felt and understood and yep. known and connected with. If I don't do that, I can't help that. You too. We can't help. So how do we help the parents too with this, the connection piece, you know? And a lot of the parents that I work with actually do have a really good relationship with their kids on a lot of levels and with a lot of types of events or activities mm-hmm. or interactions that they're having. But then when it comes to a lot of this stuff, it kind of goes out the window and we revert back to these old messages. I really want to make sure, and I don't think either of us do, but make sure any parents who are listening to this, and I'm speaking directly to Cameron and now, we are not shaming you. There's no shame in this. There is no reason. And if we all have feelings, if you have that, that's fine. But don't let that hold you back. We have stuff to process and to get through and understandings if we want to be able to help these kids. So now I went into solution.
I actually love it. But I actually want to say one more thing about that, because I think it is that important. And I do think that it's important for us to acknowledge the challenge for parents. I think, you know, the reason parents feel, you know, the way we do as parents, because as a parent, I feel the same feelings other parents feel. I freak out. I get anxious. I just happen to also have a professional hat I can occasionally remember to put on. But parents, we're wired to help our kids survive mm-hmm. and not to help them thrive. That's actually not what we're wired for. You know, the brain's got the rational prefrontal cortex. It's got the emotional fight or flight amygdala. Unfortunately, it's not just our kids who have that. It's us too. So when they freak out or they're suffering, they're struggling because of these mirror neurons, you know, that we experience their feelings. They feel anxious and they flip their lid, as Daniel Siegel says, you know, and their amygdala, their anxiety is what's running them. We start to respond with a blah, 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 you know, too. And so,
yeah, nervous system to nervous system communication.
Yeah, yeah, it's a battle of the amygdalas, and it's a nervous system to nervous system. That is not abnormal. There's nothing wrong with us for feeling that way. It doesn't help, obviously, but it is a normal way for us to respond. It's just that we apply it too liberally. We need to be able to rein it in and be the adult in the room and be able to say, whoa, my kid is really anxious. I can feel that. I can respond in a different way. So we can get into that in the solutions part.
All right. And we are there. Okay. So now, parents, we really want to give you some actionable insights, and we're going to dive into really looking at what can you do. How can you be helpful? How can you help your child in the ways that matter to you? So I'll start with a few questions, and I don't have as many, Michael, but we can go really deep on them. How do we know, let's start with the B, how do we know when the problem's been solved? You already alluded to that before.
Well, I give two answers. The short answer is mom, dad, whoever is raising, you feel relaxed. You feel good. You feel a sense of confidence in your child, and not confident that they'll do A, B, or C. That's not the confidence. I mean, you just feel confident in your child being able to make good decisions for themselves, even if it's not the decision you would make for them. That's when you know. Now, you know, what do you see? You see your child making mistakes, continuing to make mistakes, but reflecting on them. Mm. Oh, you know, I did learn something from that. I had one student, Seth, who she said, you know, I learned something recently. I said, what's that? She said, I learned that, you know, I used to just not work hard in this class because I hated the teacher. And I realized it doesn't matter how I feel about the teacher, because at the end of the year, I'm done with the teacher, but I'm stuck with the grade. So the grades are for me. And, you know, of course, like to us, that's so obvious. To parents, it's obvious. To coaches, that's obvious. But to a kid, that's a sign of maturity. It's a sign that they're getting it, that it's their life, that the reason to do well is really, it's for themselves. You know, so those are the kinds of the signs. beyond that, obviously, all the EF skills, that they can start things that they don't want to do. They can stay focused. They can get organized. And that they know when it's worth it and when it's not. Quick story example for you or not?
Please. Yeah. I something popped right in my head. Yeah.
Of course. Right. You can picture the kid. Well, I can picture this kid because it's my older daughter. One of the big indicators for me was it was senior year of high school's last year. And she said, "Dad, I'm struggling. I've got so much homework in each class, hour of this, hour of that, et cetera. And I've got this big project that's due in 2 weeks. And how do they expect us to ever get to the project since there's so much nightly homework?" And, you know, I had my coach hat on, but I said, "Do you want my coach hat on, or just to be dad and to go, oh, well, that stinks. You know, that must be very difficult." And she said, "No, I actually would like to hear your thought here." And I said, "Okay, well, I'll ask you a question. How much are the homework assignments worth?" She said, 2 points. I said, "How much is a project worth?" She said, 50. And she went, "Oh my gosh, okay." And I said, "Well, what'd you get?" She said, "What I get is I could probably cut out a little bit on the homework, just enough. I'd still get my 2 points probably, but I'd have time to start the major project little by little by little. And by the time it's at the end, I'm going to feel pretty good about the project," that kind of thing. So, you know, sending her off to college is still a little scary, you know, like, oh, she's going off on her own, but she's done great. In fact, she even said to me a few weeks in, you know, freshman year, she said, "Whoa, these other kids are so neurotic. They're freaking out about like the littlest things. And I do the work, but I really focus on the things that matter." Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's good. Like, you know, she's really ready. You know, she's really able to do this on her own now. It's pretty great. So I think that's your sign.
I really like how you put that into a somatic phrasing. You know, you're like, you feel relaxed. You feel not that anxiety, "Oh my gosh, is my kid going to be okay?" But you're like, "Yeah, they'll make mistakes. I think they're going to be okay." Like, yes. It's such an interesting A to B. Like, we're not looking for what we think we're looking for. And what we think we're looking for is the straight A's or the high test scores or the getting everything checked off the list, having no zeros, no missings, no incompletes, not getting in trouble. You know, we think it's measurable in that type of a way, but we're really dealing with life, and life is how we feel, and feeling like, huh, they're going to be okay. They can achieve their goals.
I think there really is a qualitative change and a real a palpable shift in how you feel, and also you feel better because you see your kids feel better. Again, those mirror neurons. You see your kid just sits down and gets their work done because this is what they do. I had one mom who said, "My goal is for my son to see doing his homework is just what you do, like brushing your teeth at the end of the day, you know, and in the morning, it's what you do." And it was a huge shift. You know, just, it wasn't about getting, he's got to get all A's. And that's the thing that I do say, you know, for the parents is when they get that, it's just wonderful. And I do see that, you know, often the grades do follow. Often the homework scores do go up, yep. You know, because it's just, there's less drama about the whole thing. There's less, you know, whatever.
And that's what I say in my stuff is I say, that's not the goal, but that's what happens as a result of what we're doing. And then ironically, what we're trying to do is we are actually trying to do things that are going to help that. So now let's dive into that with this solution. Yeah. So I said that I don't mean to contradict. I don't think I am contradicting myself, but I don't mean to sound like that, where it's not that grades don't exist. I mean, they're a necessary evil. They're there. They're, you know, we do have to do these things. There is also value in it. Mm-hmm. But so what, when you've taken your clients and you've gone from that point A to point B, and it's like, okay, we've had a lot of tiny, tiny changes that have added, as you said, it takes a long time, that have added up to a big change where we're like, this kid's going to be okay. What has changed, Michael? What are the sort of more executive function-y things, or the more specific things, or the mindsets, or the habits, or the what sort of more of the nuts and bolts of what you do that you're helping change?
Yeah, a couple of the most exciting things. One, kids start inventing their own tools. That is an amazing thing. I mentioned that whole DK thing to you. You know, we use that for preparing for tests. K, what I know, check, check, check. DK, XXX, better study up much more on those. DK, I've never seen this stuff on the study guide. What is this? Okay, that's the tool that I invented. I had a student who said, what about the KK? Like the stuff I kind of know. And, that's great. So he was actively thinking, I want to bend this thing to make it work for me. Number two, self-advocacy.
Can I pause right there? Because that's really good. Now we want to get into like, okay, how do parents implement that? Because I can think with what you just said, I think a lot of times parents and
I can apply that for parents. Let me give you a parent story that will help.
As a parent do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So what parents, the mistake parents often make, but this first one is we as parents often want to solve the problem. Like we just want to make it better.
Yep.
It's so hard not to. Like I said, we're wired for that. You know, neurobiologically, we want to protect and make sure our kids are okay. But don't make sure they're okay. You give them all the tools and resources. You teach them how to develop their own thinking. Anyway, so for a parent to do that, you ask questions. We use it like an I do, we do, you do model. So at the beginning, I'll absolutely say to a parent, it's fine for you to tell them something. I will do that. I'm going to show them this. I'm going to show them a tool. I'm going to reveal my thinking, tell you how I would think about that thesis statement, how I'm thinking about it. And then we shift to we do, which is like a more interactive, more let's do this. You do it. I'll do it. Let's compare notes. Let's see. And then as you do, I ask you what you think of it. And then I give you feedback. And then you just do it on your own. So I do, we do, you do, a fading support model.
Can I tie that into? There's, if parents want to Google gradual release of responsibility.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Gradual release is out there. That is a great thing to check out. Fading
support. In both cases, what we're doing is we're saying, I'm not the one disseminating all the information to you. I actually trust that you have some good thoughts in there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you don't want to be giving all the answers, because if you give all the answers, what's going to happen later? When they're stuck, they're always going to be calling you from college, from their job. Like, when does it end? So, you know.
Or they'll resent you and push you away because they don't want to hear it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So you know. Kid Kim came in and was so like, I don't want coaching. I said, okay, you know, it's going to be your decision ultimately. But why not? Just curious. And he said, I hate assignment notebooks. And everybody tells me I have to use assignment notebooks. I said, okay, why do you oppose them so much? You know, a lot of kids like them. So I'm just curious, why are you opposed? He said, because they're stupid, because the teachers post everything online. Why do I need an assignment notebook? I said, okay, do all your teachers post online every night? He said, all of them except my English teacher. I said, well, what do you do there? He said, well, I use my assignment notebook, of course. So he wasn't opposed to using it. He just didn't want to use it needlessly.
Right.
So fed up with adults telling him how he needed to do it, why he needed to do it, that it was what everyone expected. You know, he had a system that was mostly working for him, and we tracked it. And so, Seth, that was the key thing, was to be able to track things with him, to give him accurate feedback, so he could say, oh, my system really isn't working for math either. I guess in math it's worth it to write it down too. That kind of thing.
And I like what you did because you asked him why. And I think that's really good in terms of how compare and implement your teachings. Ask why. Ask deeper. Why? Why don't you like that? Why don't you like that? Tell me more. Tell me more. And then you got a meaningful answer you could do something with rather than just saying, no, you need to use the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't understand the source of their opposition, then you're just seeking to basically dominate them. And, you know, because you feel responsible or you feel guilty that what if they screw up and I've failed at my job as a parent in some way. Don't worry about failing at your job. We all fail at our job at times. We're just trying the best we can. But by understanding the way they think, we can understand, oh, all right, maybe give them a little room to experiment. All right, well, why don't you try it this way? Let's see how it goes. You know, let's try it out.
I can hear parents watching you saying, well, I know how it's going to go. If I say that to them, they're not going to do anything.
Okay, so great. Data point, but you can also, so what I like parents often say, you know, what, how would you advise me to do it? Like put the restrictions on now or put the restrictions on later? And I say, well, first of all, they have to make sense. But secondly, work that out with your kid. Let your child make the choice. So here's an example. You can say to your child, I think you need to use your assignment notebook. My experience is that it's not working for you without that. That said, I'm willing to run an experiment with you for 2 weeks. You're a freshman. Consequences are not that huge. And it's your life anyway, not mine ultimately. So we can try an experiment. And after 2 weeks, we're going to talk to the teacher, see how you did turning in assignments. And if it's not going well, then you do need to use your assignment notebook. And you're going to need to get it initialed too. Mm. Okay, wait, give me a second.
I like how you frame it because that's...
But the other half of it, Seth, is or you can just go ahead and use it. And if things are going great after 2 weeks and we get the data that you're doing great, then you have the choice to drop it because you'll know what you're giving up. So you can choose which way would you, and now you've given them a forced choice. Would you like to start without it and come up with your own way and let's get the data? Or would you like to start with it, which is what I'm recommending. With my younger daughter, this was in bio this year, she didn't want me to, take away the ads on her Quizlet, you know, or online flashcards for the parents that don't know that tool. Yeah. So I said, these ads, they must be distracting you. I could take them away. It's only $15. She said, save your money, Dad. I don't need you to do it. And I said, well, sweetie, fine. And I said, fine. And I literally hoped that she would get a bad grade, Seth. I know that's terrible, but I hoped she'd get a bad grade so I could then go, I told you. Well, guess what? She got a good grade. So I lived up to my word and I didn't make her lose the ad. But I came home a couple weeks after that and she had taped a piece of paper over the ads. And I said, what made you do it now? She said, Dad, it's a harder test this time. I can't look at those ads. She knew what she needed. But if I'd been snarky dad, controlling dad, basically the way I felt, which was wanting to control her and make it work right because I wanted her to do well because I'm a crazy person. You know, I'm just a dad. And if I had done that, she never would have gotten to find out for herself what worked, what didn't work, and to prove to herself that she did know how to govern herself in that case. And if she'd done badly, I would have said, you know, honey, I'm going to take away the ads because it's not working. It's worth the $15 to me.
And I think so often parents are so afraid that we need to figure this out now. And there's that anxiety and that drives a lot of these things.
Yes, the urgency, that survival mode.
And we don't want to watch them, quote, fail or fall, but it's so important. But we do want to do it in a way where they're supported or we're having dialogue. You know, we don't just want to let them, you know, really have horrific consequences, but we want to allow them in a safe way, a container to experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's part of where we as parents need to distinguish between whatever. There's that book, The Blessing of a Skinned Knee, The Blessing of a B Minus by Wendy Mogul. Those books, they are amazing books. A B minus is not going to kill you. A skinned knee isn't going to, in fact, those are good. I heard a saying once I always take with me, success is sweet, but failure is good food. You know, got to make mistakes. It toughens you up. It makes you stronger.
I think a lot of us adults also forget how many struggles we've gone through and how pivotal those have been. I guarantee you everybody watching this has had really terrible experiences that have catapulted us into better decision-making and better places in our life. Because because it doesn't always happen. When we have chosen to learn from our mistakes and grow from them and not just say, oh, these bad things happened to me and play the victim. But when we've said, I'm not going to experience that anymore. I'm going to do this differently. How important is that in our lives? And I think we're so afraid of letting our kids or watching our kids experience that. But it's kind of how they experience those things and how we have a secure connection with them to help them move through those things in a good way.
I'm going to take a risk here. I've never said this in a public comment, but I'm going to say
it. Let's do it.
Well, I think sometimes parents feel that they didn't always get the better of those failures. I think sometimes, you know, maybe for you and me, you know, we feel like, boy, I did not enjoy those failures. I had a lot of failures. And I mean, I had a lot of failures, Seth.
Me too, yeah.
I could list them. We would give them the accelerated failures. Failure, right.
Plan, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I've tended to frame them for myself as, okay, well, I've certainly emerged a better person from them. I've emerged at least a better human being and possibly a more successful one as well. So for me, framing them as opportunities is something I can do because that's how even though at the time they didn't feel like opportunities, I chose to make them that over time. And I do think it's harder if, as a parent, maybe sometimes you do feel like, you know, I haven't always gone that route. I have sometimes just said, I just can't. I'm overwhelmed. I remain depressed and anxious. And so at least I'm going to protect my kid. And so I think there is a part of a parent that is trying to be kind and supportive and loving.
Oh, sure.
And, yeah. You know, not just like, I want to be a snowplow parent, get everything out of the way, you know, but like, that may be the effect, but I don't want my kid to go through some of what I've gone through. And so I can get it and I feel empathy. I also know that with the right kind of support, our kids can sometimes do even better than we did. I know that many, many people do feel like I did a little bit better than my parents in terms of learning to deal with stress or challenge.
I think it can be really a gray area to know what's enabling, what's learned helplessness, what's, you know, not really helping and what is, like, where is that line? Because it's not always clear, especially when the fear and the anxiety is there.
Yeah, and I do think that sometimes that is why, honestly, why a parent might hire you or me or whatever. I know we're not here plugging our businesses, but it can be helpful to have somebody, maybe it's a cool aunt or uncle, who is just able to be an additional support sometimes when, as parents, we feel, oh my gosh, I'm so afraid to let my child fail. Sometimes getting that encouragement from someone else can be really, really helpful.
So any secure adults who have their head on somewhat straight that are good people to have around them. Absolutely. Yeah. You were going to talk about self-advocacy.
Yes.
I don't want to miss that.
Yes.
And then I'll see if I have any more questions and we'll start. Actually, then after that, I want to ask a little bit about your model and then we'll start wrapping up.
Sure. So, you know, self-advocacy is one of those things that is and just to define it, so for kids to be able to advocate for themselves, to be able to learn to run, you know, run their own lives a bit, they need to first of all have some of this quote unquote, you know, metacognition, the self-awareness. They need to be able to know, oh, here's what I am good at. Here's where I struggle, but I can figure it out on my own. Here's where I struggle, and I really do need to get a little bit of support. I want to kind of give a contrast. Here's a bad model. A bad model is, my child, you must go in for after school help. And then the kid goes in for after school help to the teacher and says, my mom told me I have to get some help. And the teacher says, okay, because the teacher isn't that impressed that your mom made you do it. And you're radiating boredom, and the teacher's mirror neurons are, you're bored, I'm bored. Yeah. So, okay. You know, and it just kind of goes downhill from there. Well, how can I help you? I don't know. I just don't get it. What don't you get? I don't know. You know, it's not very good. It takes a toll on the relationship bank account. You know, it's more of a withdrawal for both of them. And the parent's like, woohoo, I got my kid to go in for help. And the kid's like, that was awful. And the teacher is also thinking, that was a waste of my time. Okay, better model for self-advocacy begins with the child doing some pre-work before they go in to see the teacher. Again, that kind of DK, and, you know, oh, here's what I know. Here's what I kind of know, don't know. Here's what I really, I have no clue. And goes into the teacher and says, hey, I was wondering if you could help me. There are a few things here that I noted that I don't really understand. Where can I find out more about that? Oh, that's fantastic. Good for you. I'm very impressed. And whoa, you know, now you got this kind of good vibe thing going on, positive mirror neurons. Everybody's feeling good. Money in the bank for each other. Kid wants to go back and get more support. And you've developed a skill. Now your child has learned, because they're prepared when they went in for extra help. They just did a little bit of that work ahead of time. Now they know, oh, people don't mind helping me. That's first. You actually feel like people kind of like me, and they do want to help me. And which, of course, is why teachers go into the profession in the first place. They may burn out, but they don't burn out so much when they're working with kids that want to be there for help. And then secondly, you're going to do better. And when you do better, you feel better about yourself. And when you feel better about yourself, it gives you energy that you're willing to invest. And then you'll do even better. So you get into like a growth cycle.
Yeah, it's kind of like the opposite of what they do. They tend to have this trickle-down cycle, this snowballing effect of negative things happening when things start to pile up, all the missings and all that. And we reverse it in the other way, and you start having these little successes. And I'm really glad that you called the self-advocacy a skill. I'm so with you there. And remarkably, that's one of the skills that I work with kids on that is not too hard to get going. That's almost one of the easier ones. They go in one or two or three times like that, and they have a good experience. And they were that skill, you, like you said, you kind of get over this mindset. You have this mindset shift where, yeah, that wasn't so bad. And actually that teacher was kind of cool. And actually I feel more successful and things are easy. You know, so that's great. Thank you for mentioning the self-advocacy.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's important to me. I believe that's us at our best doing our jobs, and parents at their best doing their jobs, because it helps move kids toward increasing independence. They're always going to need help. We all do, right? I mean, did you do this all by yourself, this whole summit? I'm sure you talked to people. Anything I've done that's of any value, I've consulted with all sorts of people. So that skill of learning to talk to people and get ideas and learn from others that's a life skill. So, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep. And asking for help and asking for what you want and not being ashamed to do either, you know, mm-hmm. and really going for your goals. All right. So now you have been, I'm so interested to hear this, but you've been doing this for a long time, and yes, you've created models. You have languaging that you use over and over, and keywords and key concepts. And we'll start wrapping up here. If you're talking to a parent and you're saying, hey, listen, I can't work with you, but here's what I'm going to tell you to do. the next week, the next month, today, and the next semester, whatever, do these steps or this process. I know it's not linear step by step, but here's the model. Here's what you should do with this model. What actions should parents take to implement some of your core concepts?
Or sure. Concepts? So the first, really bottom line is know where your child is in terms of their readiness to change. Hmm. Are they in a state of panic? In which case, your job is to take out the urgency, take out the sense of urgency. Are they in a state of just, this stuff's boring, you know what? Make it more of a challenge. Are they in a state of denial where they're like, this stuff is just not, I don't think I even have a problem. Give them facts, give them data, but have your response match. And if they're in this state of what we call pre-contemplation, what comes from this model I mentioned, trans-theoretical model, if they're in this state of like, I can't do it, I won't do it, I don't have a problem, don't try to force them out. Start with just listening, understanding where they are, empathize, knock before entering. Is this an okay time for us to talk? Normalize it. You know what? I'm sure lots of kids feel this way. But I would say the very first thing is understand if they're in that mindset, that's where they are. And you got to meet them there. And
that's so hard for parents. I think sometimes when they're watching and they're like, if we don't figure this out now, they're going to fail all their classes. But right. I completely agree with you.
You got to start there.
You have deal with the, there has to be some buy-in. There has to be some clarity around what's going on without shame. And sometimes in that case, I don't mean to interrupt you, but sometimes in that case, you need more help than what's available from you or from the family. There are therapists who specialize in something. That is a great thing, is to get that, or the school counselor or the whatever, but
you might find that the school is able and willing, to provide a 504 plan, if not an IEP. If it's a private school, they might still provide a support plan. There are plenty of ways to work solutions out, but, if a kid's pretty shut down and, that first is they need to know you're an ally.
That's so good. So the first thing to know is to get on the same page.
Now, the relationship. Right. So if they're not in that place though, if they're a slightly better situation, you've gotten them out of that place of just total retreat, total denial.
And they're kind of ready.
Kind of ready. Right. If they're in the kind of ready state, the next thing you can do is some small experiments with them. This is the one where try out the assignment notebook, see if it works for you. If you're doing great, then you get to choose. Or let them try not using the assignment notebook, or they say that they don't need to study for the test. Okay, let's try it. You don't need, or better example, they say they don't need to study at the dining room table, that they can study in their room effectively. Okay, let's try it. And if you're able to go to bed at a reasonable time and you get back a grade that we both think is reasonable, doesn't have to be an A, but let's talk in advance. What's a reasonable grade? What are you satisfied with? You're happy with the B minus? Okay, I could live with that. Or we negotiate a little, I'd be happy with a B, but or whatever it is, or a C plus, whatever it is. Do the experiment. It comes back and it didn't go right. Kid stayed up too late. Grade was way lower than they agreed was reasonable. That studying next time is going to be at the dining room table. Or maybe they agree to start at the dining room table and prove that they don't need to study there and they can graduate then to their bedroom and study there.
How you're explaining this. And, first you need some buy-in. You got a little buy-in. You're doing some experiments. Sure. But you're having, it's not a quick fix. You're having dialogue with your child. You're unpacking these things. You're doing it in a way where there's not the pressure. You're creating a space where you can say, all right, kid, let's see how this goes, but let's be concrete. What's your expectation? What's mine? Let's see if it happens. And if not, we agree on this. And if so, we agree, but it's this sort of messy process.
It is a messy process.
You need to do this. It's a,
You can do that. You could just be a drill sergeant about it and tell them what's up, and you know, this is how you do it. You're doing it. But that
doesn't work with the kids that you and I work with.
It doesn't work with kids for long. They end up bailing. You know, in the long run, they don't develop the motivation. In the long run, they don't tend to feel as good about themselves because.
And we don't get to that B point where we're saying, okay, they've got this. You know, they're just compliant, or we're still dealing with, you know, they don't see how the relevancy that you mentioned.
Yeah. So, you know, that's part two. So part one is the connecting. Part two is experimenting with and letting them have some choice in what the experiment is, which way the experiment goes. Is it a do or not do, you know, and we look at the results. And then, you know, I think the third thing I would say, probably the most important, is I'd go back to the self-advocacy. I would say it's important for our children to learn how to be aware of what's working, what's not working, and to get help. And they could choose the form of the help. Maybe they want to go with someone like a teacher. Maybe they don't like the teacher, but there's someone else at the school. Maybe it's a friend of the family who's really good at math or whatever, or chemistry or whatever it is. Or maybe it's someone who's like amazingly cool like you or me, Seth. there's a lot of ways you can go. So I just think it's just there. But the kids have to learn ultimately to do that. And I think that should be a parent's third goal, is make sure your kid can advocate for themselves. Make sure that they know how they're doing and are able to get help. Beyond that, there's about two gazillion things that, of course, can be done. Yep. But then I'd need to know the specifics of the kid.
Yeah. And that's well put too, because you've given us some big picture principles, and then there are lots of ways to execute on those. All right, let's start wrapping this up. What specific action can parents take today to get started with your insights?
I'm gonna have to plug my book once then. The book does a better job than I can in a short time of explaining. There's a chapter on motivation. There's a chapter on how to talk.
Your kid's gonna be okay.
Yep.
Now link to that.
Building the executive function skills your child needs in the age of attention. So chapter on motivation, chapter on how you can talk to help your child move, feel respected and able to move into kind of gradually, you know, fading support model. And then there's a chapter on emotional regulation, one on attention, planning and time management, and then one on self-awareness and reflection. I think what a parent can do today, one first thing, I think it's going to sound like a broken record, but this is a record worth playing over and over again. It's about the relationship. We talk about R before T, relationship before task. We also say reach before teach. At Beyond Books, we say reach, teach, reflect, release. That's one of our little things. So you got to reach them, then you can teach them, then you can help them learn how to reflect, and then you can help them become independent from there. So reach, teach, reflect, release. But it always begins with a relationship. And so many parents I've talked to just feel they love their kids. And they're like, I want to have a good relationship with my kid, and I want them to be successful. And I feel torn between these two. So, well, if you're torn between those two, go with the relationship, because that's something you have a lot more say in. The success is up to them, and they will get there. It may not be the way you picture. It may not be at the pace you imagine. It may not be going to the college that you would hope that they went to. They will find their own way to success, and you need to believe that.
And if the relationship's there.
If the relationship is there, they have the most fundamental thing, which is somebody really cares about me.
I end almost every talk with the same concept.
It's fundamental. Most everybody there may be a few exceptions out there, but I've never met someone where everyone needs someone to care about them, someone to, you know, believe in them too.
So get the book and then do something to build the relationship today. Do something positive for your relationship today.
There you go. There you go.
And then the last one is from your heart to theirs. What's the most important takeaway you hope that these parents leave with right now? Probably just what you said, huh?
Yeah, but I would see it slightly differently based on the way you said it. I would just say be kind to yourself as a parent. I mean, it's the toughest job you'll ever love. It is. When people who don't have kids have asked me, you know, like, how is it compared to what you expected? My answer is always, it is much more involved emotionally, physically, in every way. It's much harder and more involved, and it is so much more rewarding than I ever could have imagined. But on the tough side, be kind to yourself, because it's not easy. We all feel like failures at times as parents, and just to remember that, you know, you don't have to get it right all the time. They have to know that you're trying, that you're really trying hard, and that we also are learning from our mistakes with our best intentions there.
Awesome. So much gratitude, Michael, for your time and your heart in this. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Scott.
There's a page all about Michael here. You can check that out and learn all about him. And again, just thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And parents, this is Seth Perler from the Executive Function Summit. Just want to encourage you to go take some action right now. Take care now.